Welcome to the Quick Stop Entertainment QuickCast series featuring filmmaker Terry Gilliam. Part 3.
I mean, there's no way to look at Grimm without thinking this is a very schizophrenic film.
I can't tell, to be honest. I should, I'm curious to see what I think about it in a few years' time. What was interesting is when we were, went off, because what happened really at the time I reached the end when I had screened the film, whatever screening numbers of screenings I was supposed to have, and they were still saying this film doesn't work, we don't like it, and I said, well, you finish it yourselves, and walked away. That was just because I'd had it by then. And then what happened was when we finished Tideland shooting, and I came back and they said, they wanted me to finish Grimm's My Way. When I sat down, Tony Grizzoni and I, we watched it, and we both said, this is really good. What's going on here? And we both felt the same thing. This is a good film. It may not be the best Gilliam film. It may not have all the stuff that I'm capable of, but by any standard, we both felt this is a good movie. And I think I still believe that. And I thought we were judging it outside of ourselves. We just sat back and watched it and said, wow, this is nice. So I don't know. I think what happens now is that the film has been judged so much with the battle between me and the Weinsteins as the basis of looking at the film.
And not only that, the fact that it was part of that, the infamous Weinstein dump and run.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so you get there, and I think so many reviews I've read, I said, this is bullshit, It's not a bad film. It's just not maybe as good a film as it could have been. But I'm quite keen to look at it in 5 years' time and see what I really think.
I mean, do you, for whatever this means, do you view it as a Gilliam film or just a film that you did?
No, I think it's a Gilliam film. There's a lot of it that I really, really would fight for. I think it's terrific. And other bits are a bit more conventional than I would have done. But I did set out to make a commercial movie. I had to keep reminding myself of that. I mean, and the joke is, it wasn't particularly commercial. It did all right, and it's going to make its money back. But what was it, number 40 that year internationally. That's not the worst thing that could have happened to a film.
No, not considering the amount of product that was out there.
I know. So it's not, and coming back from Japan and the distributors there, it was their number one film of the year. So, there's parts of the world that's okay. So, it's not the film that a lot of critics describe, as far as I'm concerned. And I would have been very curious to see what kind of reaction it would have got if my name hadn't been attached to it. Because these are the things that happen. When I read that it's bad acting, I think that's just wrong. I think the acting is great in the film, unless I've completely lost it.
But do you think in some ways that's a backhanded compliment that people hold, a quote-unquote Terry Gilliam film to higher standards?
I think that really was happening. I mean, everything I read, clearly the standards that they were judging the film by were not normal standards. And I felt there was a lot of that. I think also there was a lot of people who knew too much about what had gone on. And so that's in their head. This is like, when you go back to films like Hudson Hawk and The Last Boy Scout, these films were just pilloried, ripped apart. But you look at them, they're not that bad. They're pretty good. By many standards, they're not bad films. It was just, at a certain point, it was time for Bruce Willis to get the shit kicked up. And you can look at it, and you get these, it was like Fear and Loathing at Cannes, when it was, it was ripped apart. I mean, it was just savaged. It was unbelievable how the feeding frenzy took off on that film. And it got just terrible reviews. The reviews, in fact, when I look back on my films and the reviews, I've always gotten rather bad reviews. And then 5 years later, the film is considered a classic.
I'm shocked every time I go into Walmart and there's a copy of Fear and Loathing.
You got it. We broke the Walmart barrier. Criterion Collection finally makes Walmart.
Yeah, no less the Criterion Collection of Fear and Loathing.
It's the first Criterion Collection that's ever been sold at Walmart.
And sells well.
It's like I asked my son just last week, what are they watching at his school? He's 18 years old. I said, Well, they're watching Fear and Loathing is what they watch. It's their favorite film. Fear and Loathing is huge on DVD or whatever form it's being watched at, is incredibly successful. And yet there's no kind of measuring device to tell the world how successful it is or isn't. And I found at the time when it came out, Eton College, where, you know, the royals send their children, it was the most popular film at Eton.
You would have think that, you know, if it was spreading like that, Prince Harry could have picked a better costume.
He probably was the one kid who didn't get it. And it's like when I'm promoting, like going around promoting Tideland, they're all talking about Fear and Loathing, and yet here was a film that just was destroyed at Cannes. It got very mediocre reviews at best in America, and it only did, I think, $10 or $11 million worth of business in America.
I mean, of your films, I mean, if you were to look to what film in retrospect is the biggest surprise to you and how it's viewed, would it be Fear and Loathing, or is there another one that you go, you know, I'm really shocked that people don't like that one or do like that one?
No, I mean, I didn't actually think like that. I mean, the one that I enjoy the most is when people come up to me and say, Munchausen is their favorite film. And that's always a surprise.
Why is it a surprise to you? Because you don't think it's particularly one of your better ones?
I like Munchausen because, again, it got such a bad reception. It actually didn't, you know, to be fair, it didn't get a chance to get the reception. It got very good reviews at the time, but Columbia only put out 117 prints, 117 of that film. And so it never really got, you know, released. And then every time you pick up a book about the history of cinema and you find out it's deemed one of the great box office disasters of all time.
Well, that's just lazy writers.
Which, there are nothing but lazy writers out there. I mean, this is the worst thing about writing about film these days, is most of the people that write about it only just go to some database and then, oh, that's what somebody else said. I find actually reviewers have become like that. They've really gotten lazy.
I mean, you're the only thing that took the heat off of Ishtar.
Exactly.
If it wasn't for you, they'd still be the standard bearer.
That's why Warren Beatty was very friendly years ago.
See, now you know. Thank God for Terry. I can hold my head up high.
But it is extraordinary how lazy writers have become. And that's now I have to blame the web a bit for this now, because it's so easy to go, oh, there's some information. They got that. And so the sloppiness is passed on and on and on.
But I think it's generally passed on to lazy writers who work in professional capacity. I think find that, you know, the actual writing on the web of, like, fans or aficionados or, you know, film, you know, fans is actually, you know, more intelligent than what you're getting in print.
Well, you're absolutely right, especially when I read now Tideland. When I read the good writings about Tideland, it's brilliant. These are people who really got it, who are articulate, literate, and are writing something. Then there's the other guys on the message board saying, fuck that. Shit.
Well, in many ways, you're just getting to the point. It is more concise than the eloquent writers.
Exactly. At least they're letting their opinions be known.
Well, they're just sharing. It's all about discussion. It's a conversation that starts.
But, I mean, I do know that the writing, when I occasionally go on there to just check out who's writing something decent about the film, and I find that's really brilliant. And it doesn't even have to, you know, be necessarily a totally positive review, but at least they're responding to the thing, and they're thinking, and they're able to express what they're thinking, which is really exciting.
I mean, do opinions of your films in any way, shape, or hurt you at all? I mean, is there any time like a negative review will drive you to despair?
Every day. That's why I stopped reading reviews now. The distributors here in England have been having screenings of it, and they sent me sort of the reactions from all the different professional writers, and it's what I really expect, but each time it gets me when I realize that so many of them just completely absolutely cannot see the film.
But at that point, what is a distributor trying to tell you? Oh, Terry, we need to go back and reshoot this film.
No, the distributor here is great. No, they're really good because they love the film. And I think I felt more from, unfortunately, Jeremy Thomas, the producer's organization, because they need money back now, and most of the deals they're doing don't get the money back now. They're long-term things. And so they're the ones that are under more pressure because they've got, you know, money that's outstanding that needs to be repaid. And they're not saying recut the film or anything, but the feeling always is, and it always has been on every film I've done, if you just made it a bit shorter, it would be, you know, more successful.
You know, but I can't see how making it any shorter, having seen the film, could make it,
it won't.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
I keep saying it's not the length, it's the subject matter. It's what we're dealing with.
I think it's going to be uncomfortable no matter how long or short it is.
I mean, when I read some of the reviewers who say, oh, 20 minutes out of it and it'd be better. No, it wouldn't be better. It is what it is because we've trimmed it, I think, just about as tight as we can. There's still another couple minutes that can come out, but it doesn't shorten the experience, and you actually lose a little something. No, not little film. You lose a certain sympathy with, in particular, Dickens, because we can trim his scenes down, but then there are real moments that are missed, and those moments are very important. So, as I've said all along, it is what it is, and people who don't like it aren't going to like it no matter. You can cut an hour out of it, and they still wouldn't like it.
Well, people are making the exact same argument with you on Fear and Loathing.
Oh, no, on almost every film I've done, I get the same argument. And it's, you know, it's, and so when they say it's rambling and there's no narrative, this is bullshit. They don't understand what the narrative is clearly. And yes, it isn't, these films are not tight narratives. They're not like somebody robs a bank and then has to hide the money and then finds out the mob is after them and then their girlfriend leaves them. They're not those kinds of movies.
So when are you going to make a heist film?
There was what I was working on before Good Omens, but it fell through at the last moment. It was about the man who robbed the Pierre, and it's a true story.
Oh, really? You were working on that?
Yeah, with John Cusack and Dustin Hoffman. And it was one of those things where we were, strangely enough, it was DreamWorks. And there was John Cusack, who, it's a project he was, you know, co-producing, and we had sat down at a meeting for this other part, and the other part was perfect for Dustin Hoffman. It would get him an Academy Award if it was ever done. And they, you know, were hesitating, and so it was agreed they would be either De Niro, Pacino, or Hoffman. One of those three, then we'd make the movie. And De Niro passed, Pacino passed, and Hoffman was on board. And they said, sorry, we're not going to make the movie.
We didn't think you'd get to the first two.
That was the deal. Okay, we changed our mind. And it was so dispiriting. And that was one of the things that happened just before Grimm's, and that was one reason why I just said, I've got to work, because I don't get it anymore. We're Dustin Hoffman, John Cusack, on a film that's not that expensive, and they've written Dustin Hoffman off. And it was like, you know, an older Ratso Rizzo. It was exactly the stuff he does brilliantly. And they said no after months and months of work. And you get, oh, what is wrong with you people?
Well, I mean, is that project completely dead at this point?
Well, I'm not thinking about it. These are the things that, you know, I kind of only want to deal with projects that, if they're projects that I haven't initiated, people have got to really get the money together and then come to me. I'm tired of being brought into these things, spending 6 months on it, and then, oh, sorry, we don't have the money.
Please check back next week for the next part of our QuickCast interview with Terry Gilliam. www.quickstopentertainment.com